Hey, welcome to the Growth Dummies summary for the book The Millionaire Teacher by Andrew Hallam. The Millionaire Teacher shows how to start investing if you're middle class and want to retire wealthy. Andrew Hallam explains why index funds are great for growing your savings. They're much better than mutual funds, whose 1% or 2% extra fees will end up costing you hundreds of thousands of dollars over a lifetime. Our top quote from this book is, "The surest way to grow rich over time is to start by spending a lot less than you make." So who is Andrew Hallam and why listen to him? Well, he didn't grow up filthy rich. He was one of four kids and his parents had very regular jobs as a mechanic and a store clerk. So from a young age, Andrew understood that he was responsible for his own finances. As a young adult, Andrew became a private school teacher in British Columbia, Canada. This job didn't give him one of those good old cushy public sector pensions, so he knew he had to get this retirement thing figured out for himself. He read over 400 personal finance books before age 35, and the things he learned allowed him to become a millionaire and semi-retired while still relatively young. He's now very surprised that personal finance is not taught in schools. Our financial knowledge has such a giant impact on our lives, unlike so many other things we are taught in school, like equilateral triangles. I mean, when are you going to use that? Today, this book, The Millionaire Teacher, is one of the top recommended personal finance books anywhere you look. People in this subreddit, Personal Finance Canada, seem to love it. Andrew's book is so popular because he simplifies the most important investing ideas for us while also diving into enough details to make it all practical. So now let's explore some of the top lessons that I learned from Andrew's book, beginning with the first lesson, which is don't spend money on anything you don't need to build wealth faster. When Andrew first started his teaching job, he was single-minded about getting rid of his debt. He lived with roommates, even though he didn't like it. He basically survived on potatoes, pasta, and clams. He picked up the clams from the local beach by hand, which made them free. And for a while, he even rode an old mountain bike 70 miles every day to commute to his work, to save on gas. Those sacrifices paid off. He was able to save 70% of his fairly average salary and paid off his student loans in a year. After that, he began directing all his savings to his investments, and 6 years later, he bought some oceanfront property, which he aggressively paid off in a relatively short time, too. Meanwhile, his coworkers, who had felt sad for him because of his lifestyle a few years ago, were still stuck in deep debt. Does this mean we should all live like monks or act like Scrooge, hoarding our money until we're old and sick in a nursing home? Not at all. Andrew believes if you've already got enough, then it's perfectly fine to buy a luxury item for enjoyment. However, if you're starting out and trying to build wealth, then it makes total sense to avoid any unnecessary consumption. So we should differentiate between what we want and what we need. We should also ask ourselves the question, how often has buying something new actually led to more enjoyment or fulfillment in our lives? I want to share a quote from actually a different personal finance writer named Joe Dominguez, who said, quote, "We have learned to seek external solutions to signals from the mind, heart, and soul that something is out of balance. We try to satisfy essentially psychological and spiritual needs with consumption at a physical level." And that was a quote from Joe Dominguez from the book Your Money or Your Life. And by the way, if you're having trouble avoiding overconsumption in our consumerist culture, then you're not alone. So if you want to learn how to adopt a healthier perspective on money that can also help you save a lot more, go listen to our summary of Your Money or Your Life by Joe Dominguez. So in the pursuit of appearing wealthy, many people go broke. In the end, they accumulate not wealth, but stress. For example, most people nowadays buy cars on loans, even several year-long loans. They choose a car based on the largest payments they can afford, not considering the total cost of the car in the end. Other people buy the most expensive home their bank will let them sign a mortgage for. That's a dangerous situation because sudden problems like temporary unemployment or a rise in interest rates can quickly make people homeless. Here's a quote from this book. If you're considering purchasing a home, double the interest rate and figure out if you could still afford the payments. If you can, then you can afford the home. End quote. Many of us believe that a higher income would get rid of our money problems. Yet, if you look at NBA players, these basketball players make enormous salaries, but 60% of them are broke within 5 years of retiring. Lottery winners have similarly depressing statistics. And people in general, we tend to simply spend more as our income increases, a phenomenon known as lifestyle inflation. So what's the answer? Well, to really get rich, we must live like rich people do. And that sentence might not mean what you expect. Most millionaires do not buy flashy stuff. Researcher Thomas Stanley says the average millionaire's car costs just $31,367.10. And unlike what most of us assume, the average millionaire is not driving around a Ferrari or a Lamborghini. In fact, most millionaires drive a Toyota. Thomas Stanley wrote a whole book busting many of these pop culture myths of millionaires in his book, The Millionaire Next Door. After extensive surveys, he found most millionaires are regular, hardworking people, often blue-collar. They saved money over a lifetime to secure a good retirement for themselves. Andrew first found out about these frugal mindsets of wealthy people when he was working for a mechanic named Russ, who was a millionaire single dad. From this mechanic, Andrew learned a lot of money-saving advice. For example, he learned never to buy cars new or to lease them because you lose a lot of money that way. Most people who buy a new car lose thousands of dollars in just the first year because new cars quickly drop in value. Instead, this mechanic told Andrew to look for used cars which have around 60,000 miles, which is 100,000 kilometers, and that are in good shape. Following this mechanic's advice, Andrew found he could buy a car, drive it around for a year, and then even sell it for a profit. Here's a quote. On one occasion, I bought a low-mileage 12-year-old Toyota van for $3,000. I drove it around 4,000 miles from British Columbia, Canada, down to the Mexican Baja Peninsula, then on to Guadalajara, before driving back to Canada. After covering more than 8,000 miles in a single trip, I sold it for $3,500. End quote. I guess the point here is that rich people often live frugally. That's how they became rich. Sam Walton, who founded Walmart, continued to drive the same old pickup truck for decades. And when journalists asked him why, he said incredulously, well, what was he supposed to do, drive his hunting dogs around in a limousine? And by the way, if you want to learn more about how that guy became so ultra-successful while sticking to his values like frugality, go listen to our summary of Sam Walton's book, Made in America. Lots of good business advice in that book. To get started saving, first pay off all your credit cards and high-interest loans. It makes no sense to invest your money, which may earn you 10% interest, if you still have debts that are costing you 20% interest. After that, writing down your expenses is a great idea. This will shine light onto where exactly you are spending money. As the business guru Peter Drucker said, what gets measured gets managed. Summary of this first lesson. Andrew lived extremely frugally to pay off his student loans in a year and begin investing. Most millionaires also live simply. That's how they became rich. Surveys show the average millionaire drives a Toyota, not a Ferrari, and the first step to building wealth is paying off your credit cards and high-interest loans, then writing down your expenses to track where your money is going. And now we have lesson two. Use the power of compound interest to retire with $1 million, $2 million, or more. What is being wealthy anyway? Most people would probably agree you're wealthy if you don't have to work ever again. I mean, if you have wealth on paper, but you're still forced to go to a desk job you don't like at 8 a.m. every day, well, that doesn't sound very wealthy to me. So how much money do we need to save to never work again? Well, there's a good rule of thumb called the 4% rule. This means you can withdraw 4% of your savings every year and you won't run out of money because at the same time you'll be making 4% or more in interest. That's a safe assumption to make. However, if you took out more than 4% every year, then eventually you'd be running out of money. So here's what this means in practice. If you want an income of $100,000 every year in retirement, then you'll need to save $2.5 million. because 4% of 2.5 million is 100,000. Or let's say you want $40,000 every year in retirement, then you'll need to save at least 1 million. But how on earth is a regular person supposed to save that much money? Well, it's entirely possible for a person with an average income to save a million or two over their lifetime when they take advantage of the power of compound interest. So here's a quick 30-second explanation of compound interest. When you invest money, each year your money grows a little. This growth is called interest. So if you invest $500 and earn 10% interest, then you would have $550 at the end of the year. Well, that's simple enough, right? But here's where it gets very interesting. In your second year, that $550 would now earn another 10% interest and become $605. And this time, not only is your initial $500 growing again, but that $50 interest that you earned last year is now also earning money too. So compound interest is the name for this phenomenon. It's what happens when your interest itself earns more interest. And while the difference may not sound very big in this example, over many years and decades, this effect just multiplies and becomes exponential. It can make a huge difference in how much money you end up with. Compound interest is the reason why investing a few hundred dollars per month reliably turns people into millionaires by the time they're ready to retire. But the earlier you start investing, the more you can take advantage of this compounding effect and the wealthier you'll become. So a summary of this lesson, when you're retired, you can withdraw 4% of your savings every year and not run out of money. So if you want $100,000 per year, then you'll need to save $2.5 million. A regular person can invest a few hundred dollars every month and save $1 or $2 million over their lifetime because of compound interest, which is when your money starts working for you. And now lesson three, invest in stock index funds, not actively managed mutual funds. Okay, so let's imagine you've been eating wild clams and riding your secondhand bike everywhere and saving most of your money. Just kidding, of course. But now would be a good time to talk about the best types of investments to put all those savings into. Hey, you weren't planning to stuff all that cash under your mattress, were you? Andrew says the first essential part of a good investing strategy are stock market index funds. Why stocks? Well, the stock market tends to grow, so converting your money into stocks can really grow your wealth. There are two main ways regular people invest in the stock market. The first way is actively managed mutual funds, and the second way is index funds. An actively managed mutual fund is a collection of stocks. It's called actively managed because there's a fund manager who tries to pick which stocks will go up in value and only includes those stocks into the mutual fund. In theory, these mutual funds sound like a very good idea. There's a guy who's supposed to be an expert picking the best stocks for you. However, the reality is much different. Although financial advisors often push people into the direction of mutual funds, we'll be exploring some of the major downsides of mutual funds in just a minute. A stock market index fund is also a collection of stocks, but in this case, nobody is trying to pick the best stocks. Rather, an index fund invests money equally into each stock in the market. For example, the S&P 500 is a list of the 500 largest companies in the US. So if you invested in an S&P 500 index fund, that would mean you now own a tiny part of all 500 companies in that market. So why are index funds better than mutual funds? Why is Andrew clearly such a huge fan of them? Well, first, markets tend to rise over time. I mean, sure, the stock market can swing up and down wildly in the short term, but it's always grown very reliably in the long term. And this means it's a safe bet to assume the stock market as a whole will continue to grow. And that's what you're betting on when you invest in an index fund, which includes the whole market. However, it's a much more risky bet to guess which individual stocks might grow because, you know, companies go bankrupt all the time, even seemingly indestructible ones like Kodak or Blockbuster. Here's a quote. We know that stock markets can fluctuate dramatically. They can even move sideways for many years. But over the past 90 years, the U.S. stock market has generated returns exceeding 9% annually. This includes the crashes of 1929, 1973 and 74, 1987, and 2008-2009, end quote. Okay, the second reason is that index funds reliably outperform mutual funds. Although banks and the fund managers claim they know how to pick the best stocks, their actual performance is almost always worse than index funds. And even if a mutual fund was successful in the past few years, that is no guarantee they will continue to be successful. Here's another quote. In a 15-year-long U.S. study published in the Journal of Portfolio Management, actively managed stock market mutual funds were compared with the Standard & Poor's 500 Stock Market Index. The study concluded that 96% of actively managed mutual funds underperformed the U.S. market index after fees, taxes, and survivorship bias, end quote. And that brings us to the third reason, which is that index funds have far lower fees than mutual funds. An index fund usually costs you less than 0.5% in fees to invest in, while mutual funds are often over 2%. Now, this fee may sound small on paper, but if you do the math, your jaw will drop. In the book, Andrew shares one example proving how just paying 0.82% more in fees every year, that's less than 1%, will end up costing you $179,389 over 45 years. That means that extra 1 or 2% of fees that mutual funds charge actually may end up costing you a second house. Mutual funds need those larger fees to cover their additional expenses, including those banker salaries, trading costs, and sales commissions. Meanwhile, index funds can be run in a much more automated way, often with a computer. And finally, even the richest investor in the world, Warren Buffett, makes his own family use index funds. It's true, someone asked Buffett how his family would manage their money after he dies. And he said 90% of their inheritance would be put into low-cost index funds. So what does it say when Buffett himself, one of the best stock pickers of all time, doesn't trust anyone to pick stocks more successfully than a simple index fund? Okay, so a summary of this lesson. A mutual fund is a collection of stocks chosen by a professional in hopes of higher returns. An index fund lets you invest money equally into every stock on the market. Andrew highly recommends index funds because they reliably outperform mutual funds, especially when you take into account the far higher fees of mutual funds. And now lesson four, add stability to your investing with bonds. The next major part of a good investing strategy are bonds. Bonds are basically loans you make to a government or a corporation. In return for borrowing your money, they pay you an annual interest. Now, your wealth won't grow as much in bonds as it would in stocks, but bonds are a lot more stable and safe. If stocks are the hair-raising steel roller coaster in the amusement park, then bonds are the calm merry-go-round. Bonds from governments are the safest, followed by bonds from reputable corporations. Andrew says stay away from any corporate bonds that advertise a high interest rate. Those are called junk bonds because the company may be desperate, and if they go bankrupt, then you lose your money. So how much money should you put in stocks versus bonds? That usually depends how old you are. Stocks provide more potential for growth, so when you're younger, you'll probably want most of your money in stocks. However, bonds are more safe and predictable, so as you get older, you probably want to move more money to bonds. So for example, if you have most of your money in stocks and the stock market crashes when you're 30 years old, it's really no big deal because you can afford to wait the 5 or 10 years it will take for your investments to recover. However, if that happens when you're 70 years old, then you've just lost 40% of your savings, and the problem is you need to live off that money today. So that's why older people should have more money in bonds. Here's a quote. A rule of thumb is that you should have a bond allocation that's roughly equivalent to your age. Some experts suggest it should be your age minus 10, or if you want a riskier portfolio, your age minus 20. For example, a 50-year-old would have between 30 and 50% of his or her investment portfolio in bonds, end quote. Andrew says the best way to buy bonds is with bond index funds. These have much lower fees than actively managed bond funds. So, in summary, buying bonds means you're making a loan to a government or a corporation. Bonds are much more stable and safe than stocks, but they offer less potential growth. As you get older, you should move more of your savings from stocks to bonds. And now lesson 5, rebalance your investment portfolio yearly for the best growth. First of all, what is a portfolio? Well, if I heard that word as a teenager many years ago, I would imagine billionaires chuckling on a yacht somewhere. But in investing, your portfolio simply means your collection of stocks, bonds, and other investments. So rebalancing your portfolio means regularly making sure you still have the right percentage of your money in the right places, in the right investments. To help you understand why you'll need to rebalance your portfolio and how this works in practice, let's use a real-world example. So imagine there's a 50-year-old guy named Bob who invested 50% of his money into a stock index fund and 50% into a bond index fund. Now, the problem is these different investments will naturally grow at different rates. So after 1 year, Bob's stocks may have grown by, let's say, 15%, while his bonds only grew by 5%. As a result, he now has 55% of his wealth in stocks, while only 45% is in bonds. This is a problem because now the balance of his portfolio doesn't fit his investing goals, whether it's for growth or for safety. So if Bob wanted to rebalance his portfolio, he would have to sell some of his stocks to buy more bonds, making his portfolio return to that 50-50 split of stocks and bonds. And there's also another big benefit to this practice. Rebalancing forces you to buy low and sell high. So when you rebalance your portfolio, that almost forces you to buy investments when the prices are going down and sell your investments when the prices are going up. Going back to our previous example, it was only when Bob's stocks rose in value that he had to sell some of them to buy bonds. If his stocks had fallen in value, then he would have to do the opposite, selling some bonds to buy more of the falling stocks. Now, most investors want to do the exact opposite of this. They love to buy when the price of an investment is shooting up. Like if there's some exciting new tech stock, then everyone wants to jump on the train. But when the price of an investment is falling, then everyone wants to sell, sell, sell. And that's often what happens during a stock market crashes. The news goes into full panic mode, and normally rational people start considering selling all their investments for bars of physical gold to keep in their safe. Warren Buffett says, people forget that buying a stock is buying a part of a real company. So when stock prices temporarily go down, that doesn't change the value of the company at all. All that's really changed is the price. This means the company is basically on sale now, just like things go on sale in the supermarket. Warren Buffett says stock prices going down is good news for him and for everybody who's saving and investing, because that is when to go shopping for bargains. Here's a quote. Most people like buying shares that have risen in value, and they like selling shares that have fallen in value. Smart investors don't do that. They add money to their investments every month. They rebalance once a year, end quote. But now you might be asking, well, why not simply sell your stocks when they're at a peak and then buy when things are the cheapest? Sell high, buy low, am I right? Well, that sounds like it should be a good idea in theory, but most investors who try to do that, it's called timing the market, by the way, they end up making a lot less money over a lifetime. Why? Well, because the market is so unpredictable. Nobody can really guess when the stocks will suddenly jump, and if you're standing on the sidelines, then you'll be missing most of the gains. Here's a quote. Vanguard's Bogle, who was named by Fortune magazine as one of the four investment giants of the 20th century, has this to say about market timing. After nearly 50 years in this business, I do not know of anybody who has done it successfully and consistently. I don't even know anybody who knows anybody who has done it successfully and consistently, End quote. So a summary of this lesson is rebalancing your portfolio means making sure you still have the right percentage of your investments in stocks versus bonds. You need to do this because some of your stocks will grow much faster than bonds or vice versa. This strategy also helps maximize your gains because you buy when prices are going down and you sell when prices are going up, which is the opposite of most investors. Lesson 6 is look for low fees when buying index funds. Whichever bank or investment company you choose to invest with, make sure the fees are as low as possible. Remember, even an extra 1% of yearly fees can easily cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars over a lifetime. With that money, you could buy an extra cottage or a private plane. So where is the best place to open an account? Well, in America and many other countries, Vanguard is highly recommended. This company was founded by John Bogle, who wrote some classic personal finance books himself. What's really cool is he set up Vanguard almost like a nonprofit company. Everybody who invests money with Vanguard technically owns the company, and this allows them to keep their fees very low, usually lower than anywhere else. In Canada, Andrew recommends TD Bank's E-Series index funds, and these allow you to buy index funds automatically every month without paying commissions when you buy or sell, and with low fees. Andrew recommends you create a portfolio that includes a bond index fund, a domestic stock index fund, and an international stock index fund. So why both a domestic and international stock index fund? Well, to spread your risk. So even if your own country's stocks do badly for the next few years, there's still another part of your money that can grow in the international stocks, or vice versa. In the book, Andrew was giving advice to a 40-year-old professional named Chris, and here are the exact Vanguard funds he said to buy. Quote, here's the allocation I recommended. 35% Vanguard US Bond Index, 35% Vanguard Total US Stock Market Index, 30% Vanguard Total International Stock Market Index, end quote. Relatively recently, more automated ways have been created to invest in diversified index funds. One great service is Vanguard's Target Retirement Fund. So with that one, you just put all your savings into this one fund and you don't have to worry about buying different funds or rebalancing anything. They do all that for you. And what's even better is they make sure the balance of stocks and bonds fits your stage of life. For example, if you plan to retire in 2050, then you would invest in Vanguard's Target Retirement 2050 Fund. And right now, this fund contains more stocks, but over the next 30 years, it'll automatically shift to more bonds as that target retirement date of 2050 gets closer. Andrew's wife uses this type of account. A study by Morningstar found that people who invest in these types of automated accounts often do better than investors who do everything themselves. It's probably because they remove human bias from the equation. When people just put money in every month, no matter how optimistic or pessimistic the news happens to be this week, well, they end up getting a far better return. Summary of this lesson is, in the US and many other countries, Vanguard provides some of the lowest cost index funds. In Canada, Andrew recommends TD's E-Series accounts. Vanguard's target retirement funds are also a great automated option that does most of the work for you. You just put money in every month. Now, lesson 7 is counter your financial advisor's predictable objections to index funds. Andrews discovered that for many people, the most difficult part of investing in index funds is getting past the objections of their financial advisor. Why? Well, because financial advisors make more money selling actively managed mutual funds, and they make very little money selling index funds. The truth is that most of these advisors and brokers are really well-paid salespeople. Asking them if index funds are good is like walking into a Honda dealership and asking if Ford cars are any good. So when you go into your bank to set up a portfolio of index funds, you should expect resistance. Andrew has often come in with his friends to these financial advisors' offices to see what they say, and he found that advisors have a few predictable arguments against index funds. Really, it's more like sales rhetoric. The biggest argument you'll probably hear is that you'll get a higher return with mutual funds. They'll say index funds only provide an average return, while they can pick the top-performing mutual funds for you that will give an above-average return. However, like we said before, just because a mutual fund did well in the past does not mean it will continue to perform in the future. This is proven by looking at the data. Here's a quote. The SPIVA Persistence Scorecard gets published twice a year. It looks at actively managed funds that are among the top 25% of performers. And it found that there were 682 U.S. stock market funds among the top 25% of performers as of March 2013. By March 2015, just 5.28% of them remained among the top quartile, the top 25%, end quote. Second, even when mutual funds do perform a little better than index funds, those gains are quickly eaten up by the much larger fees. These include expense fees, additional trading costs, taxes, and let's not forget the sales commissions. In summary, if financial advisors make money selling mutual funds and not index funds, they'll say they can pick the top-rated mutual funds that give better returns, but studies show past historical performance of a mutual fund does not equal future performance. They also gloss over the much higher fees of mutual funds. That's all for this summary. Personally, I thought this book was really great, like an A to Z manual. Anybody can read this book and learn roughly what they need to do to achieve a good retirement, and now it's up to you to do it. I'd also recommend you check out our summary of Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki. That is a light and fun introduction to investing from the perspective of Kiyosaki's childhood in Hawaii. He basically grew up with a biological poor dad, and then he also met his friend's father, who was his kind of like his rich dad. He was a successful business owner, and he learned a lot from it. So in that book, he shares tips for buying real estate, opening corporations, and spotting business opportunities. That was Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki. And I'll see you in the next book summary.